Numbers, Chapter 13 and Chapter 14, the third talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on November 7, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at Numbers again, Numbers chapter 13 and chapter 14. Up to now, what we've looked at is the trip that the children of Israel have made from Mount Sinai to the southern border of Palestine. And what we've seen is that this trip has been characterized by discontent, rebelliousness, disobedience towards God. That's not different from the previous part of the trip that's recorded in Exodus, that is, the time when they left Egypt till they get to Sinai, and the time while they're at Sinai. I think it would be fair to say that that whole period of time is characterized by discontent, complaints, and rebelliousness. It does seem to be the case, however, that the rebelliousness becomes more bold as time goes on, and the complaints become more petty. And in response to that, God steps in and begins to punish people for their rebelliousness. And we have seen that in chapters 10 through 12 in Numbers. But nevertheless, God is throughout this period of time faithful to his people, forgiving and patient throughout this whole trip. Even in his punishment, he has been merciful. Only a few have died. He's been quite gentle with them. But that characterizes these people that have been making their way from Egypt to the southern edge of Palestine. And what happens now in chapters 13 and 14 are not unexpected, given the track record. Before we start reading, let me just do a brief geography of Palestine. I don't have a map. I don't have any visuals. So let's do a mental. I liken Palestine to the Willamette Valley. It's about the same size, both in length and in width. It's about the distance from Portland to Eugene is the distance from north to south in Palestine. The distance east to west is about the width of the Willamette Valley at the southern end, and as with the Willamette Valley, it narrows as you go north. If you do a cross-section of Palestine, there is a coastal plain that is broader at the south, and it narrows towards the north. But it is typically rather narrow. Then it rises up into an area of grasslands and pasture lands called the Shephelah, which is wider at the south, and it narrows to disappearing as you go further north. Then it rises to an elevation of about 3,000 feet, a ridge of mountains that goes from north and south, and Hebron, Jerusalem, the main cities of central Palestine are located on those hills. Then it drops off just east of that down into the Arabah, the great rift in which the Jordan River is located, then the Dead Sea, and then south of the Dead Sea, it's also a depression. And the Arabah has, I believe, the lowest elevation of land in the world. It goes below sea level. So that's the topography going east to west. Then at the very north, there's a large valley, the valley of Esdraelon or Armageddon. Okay, so that's roughly the territory of the promised land. Now, there is one other section to that, and that's the Negev. Negev means arid land. It's a triangular piece of land that you tack on to the southern end of that. It is arid, like it's not desert. Further south, the Sinai, that's real desert. The Negev is dry land, but it's not that dry. It's like eastern Oregon. I believe they get around 10 inches of rain per year. So that is can be used as for grazing purposes. The Israelites at this particular point in time are in Roseburg. They're in Kadesh Barnea. They're about 60 miles south. They're just at the southern tip of the Negev then. That's where they're camped, and that's where the action that we'll be reading takes place as they're just about to go into the land. Let's read the first section, Numbers 13, 1 through 24. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These then were their names. From the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, the son of Zakur. From the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat, the son of Hori. From the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. From the tribe of Issachar, Igal, the son of Joseph. From the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. From the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Raphu. From the tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi. From the tribe of Joseph, from the tribe of Manasseh, Gadi, the son of Susi. From the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali. From the tribe of Asher, Sether, the son of Michael. From the tribe of Naphtali, Nabi, the son of Vorfsi. From the tribe of Gad, Goel, the son of Machi. These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. He said to them, "Go up there into the Negev. Then go up into the hill country, and see what the land is like, and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and how is the land in which they live, is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live, are they like open camps or with fortifications? And how is the land, is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort, then, to get some of the fruit of the land." Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob at Labo Hamath. When they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. Now first I want to apologize if I mispronounced any of the names in there. It's likely. Okay, what's happened is the Lord says to Moses, send some men to look at the land that we are going into. This is to look at Canaan. Now, it's this same incident is recorded in Deuteronomy as well, because in Deuteronomy, just before they are finally going into the land, Moses is talking to them and he is recounting a lot of their history, and in particular their history in the trip from Egypt to Palestine. And in that account, he says that it's the people, it's the Israelites themselves who wanted to send spies into the land. Let me read that. quickly. I can turn my pages. Deuteronomy 1, let's see, it's verse 22. He says, "Then all of you approached me and said, 'Let us send men before us, that they may search out the land for us, and bring back to us word of the way which we should go up, and the cities which we shall enter.' And the thing pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one man for each tribe." So in Deuteronomy, it's the people's idea. Here in Numbers, it's God's idea. It says that God spoke to Moses. I don't think that those are incompatible. There are a couple ways that that could be put together. It seems to me that at least one of them is, and a likely one is, that the people came to Moses with this idea. They want to know what's ahead of them. And they ask Moses, "Let's do the prudent thing here. Let's send some people into the land to see what it's like and to bring back information that will be helpful." And Moses possibly then appealed to God, and God's response was, "Yes, do that. That's a good idea." In any case, as we see it recorded here in Numbers, God tells Moses to send men out. Of the men that are sent out, there are two that are of note, and we will, as the account unfolds, we will come back to these two. But one is Caleb. Caleb means dog. And it is part of a name. There are other names that have been found in the ancient Near East that contain Caleb. Typically in the Mesopotamian area, there would be a name something like Caleb of Marduk, so dog of Marduk. And the connotation seems to be dog stands for an obedient servant. So the name, as you would see it in Mesopotamia, would be obedient servant of Marduk. Here in Caleb, there's the God part of the name has been dropped off. It's no longer a part of his name. It's just Caleb is his name. Caleb is a Kenizzite. The Kenizzites are Edomites, and the Edomites are descendants of Esau. So technically speaking, Caleb is not a son of Abraham. But apparently his tribe has been adopted as part of the tribe of Judah even before the Exodus. The other person of note here is Hoshea, or the one that's also called Joseph. Hoshea is the name that's listed, but it says in 16, isn't it 16? Yes. "But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua." Now, Joshua has been mentioned previous in the narrative on a couple of occasions. Once it just mentions that he had become a servant of Moses. I think that's in Exodus that it first mentions that. Then if you'll recall in chapter 12, it was Joshua that became concerned when Miriam and Aaron voiced their complaints about Moses' leadership. And he was afraid that there might be a coup that was brewing. So Joshua is closely associated with Moses as we go through the narrative. And Hoshea means he saved. Joshua means Yahweh saves. So Moses has changed his name and has built Yahweh into the name. So Yahweh saves is what it means. Okay, why send spies? As I've been thinking about the narrative, it looks suspicious to me that my previous understanding of how God led them through the wilderness is not accurate. My previous understanding was that God was leading them in the cloud and basically guiding every step. such that they knew right where they were supposed to camp. They knew just which path they were supposed to take over the mountains and all that sort of thing. But because of what it said in Numbers 10, in which Moses tries to get his son-in-law, Hobab, to stay with them to serve as a guide, and that seems kind of strange. If God is guiding their every step, why do they need a guide? Why would Moses want someone who's knowledgeable about the desert? And now this time, they want to go into the promised land and scout it out. Why would they need to do that if God is leading their every step? Well, my suspicion is now that God wasn't that, he was not micromanaging their movements. He was providing a more general kind of guidance, but he wasn't micromanaging it. So as I'm picturing it now, we've got this cloud that's moving ahead of them, but it's not telling them which route to take over the mountain to get to the other side. They're having to figure that out themselves. They just know where they need to go. It's north, but they have to figure out how to get from where they are to the other side of the mountain pass. So as I'm piecing it together now, it seems like God is giving them, they have to work stuff out as they go along. And God is encouraging them to make prudent steps as they go along and is not telling them every step that they should take. If that's the case, then it would make sense for them to send scouts into the land to see what they're up against, to see which passes they should take, plan their attacks, etc. The other reason why they want spies is, I think this is consistent with the perspective of the Israelites right along. They aren't sure that they trust God. They want to have independent information that they can use to decide exactly what they're going to do and if they're going to do it. They want to know what they're up against, what kind of opponent that they're going to face. In any case, though, there doesn't seem to be anything improper about sending in the scouts. God is telling them to send in the scouts. And that's what they do. Moses tells them where to go. How does he know anything about the geography of Palestine? Well, I think that the answer to that is, if you recall, Moses was adopted as the son of Pharaoh. He was taken into Pharaoh's daughter's household and raised in Pharaoh's house. And presumably, he received an education fitting for an Egyptian prince. And an education that was fitting for an Egyptian prince would have included knowledge about Palestine. Because the Egyptians know, even at this stage in history, they know that if an attack is going to come to Egypt, it's going to come from the north through Palestine. Palestine is called the land bridge that connects Africa to Asia. That's because it's the only reasonable land route to get from Asia to Africa. Egypt has nothing to fear not much to fear to its west. It has not much to fear to the south. It has not much to fear from the east. Its only threat would come down from the north. So Moses probably knows a lot about Palestine. He knows a lot about the geography. He probably knows a lot about who lives there. But it's all book learning. So now, as they're at the doorstep of Canaan, he's sending scouts out to get information that would be important in their planning this invasion of the land that God has given to them. What is it that they are supposed to learn? There are two aspects of what he asked them to find out. The first is military intelligence. Who are these people? How strong are they? How numerous are they? What about the land? And I think here when he's asking about the land, it's about terrain. What is the terrain? What can we expect when we start thinking about our attack? Are the cities fortified? Are they walled? Are they tent cities? What kind of cities are they? So that's the first part of what Moses asked them to find out. The other half is agricultural intelligence. What kind of land is this? Is it fertile or is it not fertile? What kind of resources are there? Is there timber there? And he asked them to gather some fruit to bring back as representative of what the land produces. Now, Moses, I think, is being rather balanced here in what he's asked them to do. He's asked them to gather the kind of information that is probably most important for the people, and that is, what are we up against? What kind of opposition will we face? But he has also asked them to gather information with respect to what kind of land is this that God has given them, so that they have both of those, a balanced view of what it is that God has gotten them into. The text mentions that it was the time of harvest, so presumably that's in the fall. That means they left Sinai after Passover, so in the spring sometime, late spring, and they have spent the summer making their way from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. And now we're in probably the early fall when they are on the doorstep of the Promised Land. Where do these spies or scouts go then? Presumably they travel together. It's not clear. It doesn't say specifically. But presumably we've got these 12 men who travel together. And I think in terms of scouts rather than spies. I don't think they were James Bond types with disguises and all that sort of thing. They're just going to look. They're going to see what's there. And there are 12 of them. They're probably traveling just as a group of nomads, and they're going from place to place investigating to see what they can find. They go as far as Dan, which is at the very north of the Promised Land. So they went the whole length of the territory. The area that it mentions specifically is Hebron. That's significant because Hebron is the area that was Abraham's stomping grounds. Hebron is the area that Abraham moved to and lived out most of his life. That's where Sarah and Abraham are both buried. And so these scouts made sure that they checked out Hebron to see what it was like there. And what they found there was particularly disturbing. What they found there were there were people inhabiting that area, and it characterizes those people as the sons of Anak. And it will talk about these later, but the sons of Anak would indicate that they are large of stature. They are giants. And apparently, Goliath would have been the kind of person that they're talking about. So there were really big basketball player types that were inhabiting the area around Hebron. So the scouts see all of this. They gather samples of what's produced in the land, a cluster of grapes that must have been truly huge because it took two men to carry it on a pole. So it must have been a bigger cluster of grapes than I've ever seen. Pomegranates, figs, etc. So they're bringing a sampling of what this land produces. It mentions, by the way, in the text that Hebron was 7 years older than Zoan. Zoan was the capital of Egypt. I'm not sure why this is thrown in, but antiquity to people of those times was very important. Antiquity gave things legitimacy. It gave things gravity. And it's interesting that Hebron is 7 years older than the capital of Egypt. And I think it's an indication that this land has a respectable history. It's not an insignificant place. All right, next section is the report that the spies bring back, starting with verse 25. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran and Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So the scouts come back, and they give a report, and they give the report to Moses, but apparently they give the report to Moses in the hearing of a gathering of the rest of the Israelites. So there's a big crowd that is gathered to hear what these scouts have to say. And they show everyone the fruit that they have brought. And to people who have been in the desert for a year and a half, that must have been very impressive. But then they tell them about what they have seen, and their report has two parts to it. They come saying, "We've got some good news and we've got some bad news." The good news is, it really is a land flowing with milk and honey. It really is a fertile and productive land. And this expression, "a land flowing with milk and honey," it's not clear what that means, but there is apparently some precedent for that describing flowing with milk and honey is a description used for paradise. That paradise is a place flowing with milk and honey. In any case, the description must be a description of a place that is very productive. That's the good news. This is a good land. The bad news is there are big people there. Lots of big people. Big, mean people. And so it lists the different groups of people that are inhabiting this land. And there are lots of groups of people inhabiting this land. So that's the report that the scouts give. And as soon as they give the report, it doesn't tell us exactly how the people respond. It just says that Caleb quieted the people. So you can imagine they're all murmuring. I mean, there's just this murmur going through the crowd. They're all going, "Oh my goodness, this is horrible." And Caleb's response is interesting because he doesn't correct anything that the scouts have said. He doesn't dispute that the report is untrue. The report that was given is a fair report. All he says is, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." So it's not a dispute about the facts. It's about the implication. The implication is we should go anyway. At Mount Sinai, after the incident with the golden calf, God was angry with the people of Israel. But then he relented in his anger and decided to forgive them. And he ratified, he seconded, restated the covenant that he had made with them previously. And let me read what he says there. This is in Exodus 34, starting with verse 10. Then God said, "Behold, I am going to make a covenant. Before all your people, I will perform miracles which have not been produced in all the earth, nor among any of the nations. And all the people among whom you live will see the working of the Lord, for it is a fearful thing that I am going to perform with you. Be sure to observe what I am commanding you this day. Behold, I am going to drive out the Amorite before you, and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite." So God had told them before at Mount Sinai that I will drive those people out. That's my promise. Caleb is taking that promise seriously. So the news, the report that there are all these people inhabiting the land, and even if they're big people, that doesn't matter to Caleb. He takes God at his word. The crowd, however, and the other scouts that went with him, they draw a different conclusion from the report. In fact, what the scouts do then is they restate the report, but now they give it in exaggerated terms. They say, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And it's not clear what it means there. It eats them up. I don't know whether that's in warfare, whether he's saying it's a very militarized area, but I suspect it's something along those lines. It's a vicious area, a very vicious territory, and it just eats people up. It goes on, and they go on to say, "And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size." Now that's an exaggeration that they didn't make in their first version of their report. "There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So the whole thing becomes exaggerated now in the mouths of the other scouts. It's much more dire than the original report had been. And that obviously has a big impact on the people of Israel. Let's read the next section in chapter 14. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt.' Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh and those who had spied out the land, of those who spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel." So the response of the people of Israel is to be despairing. This is a hopeless situation. I wish we had died. It would have been better to die in Egypt. And if it hadn't been better to die in Egypt, at least to have died in the wilderness. That would be better than now to have to go into our sure death. We're just marching into our sure death. And furthermore, our children and our wives will be nothing but plunder to the people that we fight against. So what should we do? We should appoint a leader and turn around and go back. What had been a theocracy, that is, God is the one who had appointed Moses to be their leader, now we've got a democracy. Now the people are going to decide who's going to lead them. God has messed it up badly. The response of Moses and Aaron is very interesting, and I'm not sure exactly what to make of it. Moses and Aaron fall on their face. It says, fall on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. I don't know exactly why they're doing that. I don't know what that indicates. My guess is that they realize that what they've heard from the mouths of the people of Israel is rebellious to the point of being blasphemous. It is rebellion that is absolutely outrageous. They can't believe that what they've heard has come from the mouths of their fellow Israelites. And I think it's the kind of response that you would have when you sense that a lightning bolt is about to strike those who have uttered it. That it's just, they're just shocked. And they fall on their faces in, I assume, in reverence before God. Joshua and Caleb speak out, advocating that they need to go ahead. They ought not be discouraged and despairing by what they've heard, and that what the Israelites are proposing is outrageous rebellion. They say, do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. What's the response of the people? They want to stone them to death. What a strange response. They don't just ignore them. They see them as a threat, because I think that in their heart of hearts, they know that what they're doing is rebellious against God. So they need the voice stilled. It's very troublesome to them. So they're about to stone them. And this reminds me of, it comes up in Stephen's speech in Acts, and there are other places where God points out every time he sends his spokesman to the people of Israel, they want to kill him. They want to stone the representatives that God sends to his own people. And this would be another one of those instances. So they're picking up stones ready to kill Joshua and Caleb, and I don't know whether Moses and Aaron, they're probably in this as well, when the glory of the Lord appears in the tent. That had to have been a dramatic moment. Right then, the glory appears in the tent of meeting. The next section. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it. For by thy strength thou didst bring up this people from their midst, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that thou, O Lord, art in the midst of this people, for thou, O Lord, art seen eye to eye, while thy cloud stands over them, and thou dost go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. Now if thou dost slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of thy fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now, I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as thou hast declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of thy loving kindness, just as thou also hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. This is the Moses that we expect to see. This is very different from his response in chapter 10, in which he despaired of being the leader of this people. God, why do I have to be the leader of this people? Here, once again, he's very empathetic with them and intercedes on their behalf. Now, what God wanted to do here, what God is suggesting to Moses, is the same thing that he had suggested at Mount Sinai after the incident with the golden calf. He's saying, I'll just destroy all the Israelites and I'll start over with just you, Moses, and I will create a greater people out of just you. But that's not satisfactory to Moses. Moses is thinking that would be bad because the promise that you made was to the descendants of Abraham. It's important that you, God, fulfill that commitment. That would be better. His argument has two parts. The first is the Egyptians will hear of it. If God were to destroy the Israelites in the wilderness, the Egyptians who knew that God was in the midst of the Israelites, they would spread the word all over the world that Yahweh was not up to the task of bringing the Israelites into the land that he had promised them. And if God is not up to the task of taking care of his own people, what kind of a God is he? That's his first argument. His second argument is, God, that wouldn't be characteristic of you. Because the Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, or that's chesed, in loyalty. Forgiving iniquity and transgression. So he's saying, that's not the way you do things. That's not in keeping with your character. You are patient. You're forgiving. You're merciful. Respond in that same way here. Just as you have all the way along from Egypt until now, you've been patient. You've been gracious. You've been forgiving. Continue to do that. Now in this, Moses grants that even though God is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, he grants, nevertheless, that God, but be patient and forgiving and gracious as you always have been. So, God relents. Verse 20. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word, but indeed as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurn me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days. For every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you shall know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do in all this evil generation, congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they shall die. As for the man whom Moses sent to spy out the land, and who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report of the land died by a plague before the Lord. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh remained alive out of those men who went to spy out the land. So God relents. Rather than destroying them all, he follows the advice that Moses had given him, and he decides not to destroy all of them. But he's determined that his glory will be apparent to all the world. He's going to accomplish that. These are the people who have seen God act, and they've seen him act mightily, and yet they have refused to trust him. He says that they have tested him 10 times. 10 may be like, may be used here kind of like a dozen. It's not an exact number, but a dozen times. And therefore, this generation will not enter into the land. They are going to die in the wilderness, just as they feared God had led them to do. They feared that God had led them into the desert just to die. But now, because they have rebelled against God, God is going to allow them to die in the desert. But Caleb had a different spirit and was obedient. Therefore, he and his descendants will be allowed to go in. So that's what God says to Moses is going to happen. He has them announce this to the people. And when they announce it to the people, they announce that everyone 20 years or older is going to die. So they had just taken the census before going into war. The census was taken earlier in Numbers. And now it's those people who are over 20 that are going to die. All those for whom the census was taken. And remember their fear for their wives and children, because they would become plunder if they followed God and went in and were defeated. Well, those children are the very ones that are going to inherit the land. If they were truly worried about their children, God does a better job of taking care of them than they do. But even the children will suffer, because for 40 years they will be living in the wilderness as shepherds. Then God sends a plague, and all of the other scouts that had gone in with Joshua and Caleb die of this plague because of what they've done. Okay, last section. I will try to do this quickly. And when Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. In the morning, however, they rose up early and went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, "Here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised." But Moses said, "Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Do not go up, lest you be struck down before your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there in front of you, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from following the Lord. And the Lord will not be with you." But they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses left the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. So, they're sorry. But what are they sorry of? They're sorry that they don't get to go into the Promised Land and that they are going to be punished. They are not sorry that they were disobedient, as is demonstrated by the fact that God tells them not to go now, and they insist on going anyway. It's a scene that I've seen my children do when they are not truly repentant. They just are sorry of the consequences of their actions. So they get up early in the morning, they head off for the hill country, and they are defeated badly and chased all the way back to Hormah, which is back in the Negev. And many of them then died there, just as they were afraid that they would die by doing what God had asked them to do. Now they die doing what they decided to do. The interesting thing about this passage, the striking thing, is here we have a group of Israelites that we've seen marching through the wilderness, and they are rebellious against God. They're always wanting to go back. They're always thinking, oh, I wish we could go back to Egypt. They see all of the things that God has done to provide for them, and the things that God has done are phenomenal. The signs that he performed in Egypt are unprecedented historically. He brings them through the Red Sea, unprecedented. He provides for them with manna. He provides fresh water out of rocks. He provides quail for them. The pillar of fire and the cloud are leading them. So the things that God has done to show his love and care for them are, it's all unprecedented. What is their response? Consistently, they take it for granted. The Israelites are like adolescents who just assume that the house gets cleaned, the dishes get washed. It just happens. It's not, nobody does it. It just happens. They take it for granted rather than understanding that those kinds of activities are acts of service and love for the adolescents. So we have here a group of people that's stuck in adolescence. They can't see through what's going on to appreciate what God is doing for them. They take it for granted. And there is a time when God says no more. There is a time when God chooses to punish the wicked. And for this generation, that time came. It was time for God to punish the wicked. So this whole generation was punished for their rebelliousness, and they were not allowed to go into the land. But nevertheless, God was loyal and faithful to his promises. And his promises were that he would make of the descendants of Abraham a great people, and that they would occupy the land of Canaan. And God is determined that that will happen nevertheless. Furthermore, even in this generation, God is faithful to those who have a different spirit, to those who are obedient. Caleb and Joshua are spared the fate of their peers, of the rest of their generation, because they were obedient to God. But even they had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Even they have to a certain extent, suffer the fate of the people as a whole. Okay, I've gone long over time. Let me take a couple questions, I hope. I hope the people taking care of children will be merciful.
Verse 35, where he says, this evil congregation who are gathered together against me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take your kids to the fair and they're afraid to ride the rides because they're tall and fast and scary, you wouldn't feel like punishing them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd say, yeah, you're afraid. Don't be afraid.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But it strikes me that there's something going on here, because God doesn't say, don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. He's saying, you are gathered against me.
Right.
What are they rebelling against? What are they refusing that's so damning in a revelation of their character?
Well, I think ultimately is God's mastery. What they don't like is God being in charge. They want to make their own decisions as to what is is wise and prudent and what is not wise and prudent. And they don't trust God to make those decisions. So it's yes, there's reason for there to be, it's understandable that there would be fear, but that fear needs to be tempered by their knowledge, their experience with God up to this point. God has shown them abundantly that He cares for them, that He is willing and able to do whatever it takes to accomplish His promises, to bring about His promises. And they are saying, I don't trust you. Despite the evidence, I don't trust you. One more, and then I better.
This is about last week, mm-hmm. regarding miracles and logic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you... Okay. God cannot... is not subject to non sequiturs. Would you argue that?
Okay.
All right. If that's true, if that is... with that assumption, then why do we look at miracles and you have the laws of physics, you have a lot of the anatomy of the physical world. It seems to me that it's a non sequitur to violate those principles that govern the physical world. Now, maybe I'm missing something here, but... it's interesting with the entropic process and sin, and yet a pure God enters in. I'm not sure it violates those laws of physics or those material laws. I just wonder if there isn't more flex in it that allows for holiness. Instead, we tend to check ourselves out when it comes to miracles. We're very adamant about logic and how God is subject to those laws. Yet when it comes to miracles, it seems like we do a complete about face mm-hmm. and contradict ourselves and our thinking.
Mm-hmm. Let me both think about that and take more time next week and talk about that, because I'm nervous about the people taking care of children. So I will address that next week, and then I will leave more time for questions next week also. Thanks.